From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Tomorrow will mark 1 week since the 7.8 magnitude earthquake struck the high Himalayan nation of Nepal. The official death toll as of today, 6,260. Not finished. The number of people who cannot sleep in their own homes, around 2.8 million. Relief efforts have barely begun to scratch the surface of the challenge. Nepal is a very special place, and right now it is in deep trouble. This hour on Point Nepal, struggling to rise out of the rubble of the big quake. You can join us online or on air. This conversation is always on online. Do you have family there, Nepali relatives, family working there on relief? What are you hearing? What will it take? What does Nepal need? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. The story just keeps going. Yesterday, just as Nepalese and rescue workers were getting used to the idea that only the dead might remain under the rubble, international and local rescuers found 15-year-old Pemba Tamang still alive in his collapsed building. Reports today say Pemba is fine, but here he was yesterday as he was dragged out from under bricks, beams, furniture. You can hear his cries of pain amid the frenetic shouts of his rescuers yesterday. It's fine, an amazing and heartening discovery. As the quake unfolded, here's the sound of people in the streets of Kathmandu last Saturday. And you can hear it right there. And so many left outside their homes, afraid to go back. Here's a 13-year-old Nepali boy talking with NBC News on Sunday.
I'm feeling so nervous and bad for this earthquake. Many people are running here and there for their lives. Many houses are falling here and there. Many people are dying also.
Yes, they have. And on the flanks of Mount Everest. Here's some footage from the quake-triggered avalanche that hit the Everest base camp. Killed 19 Sherpas and climbers injured over 60. Footage shot here by climber Jos Kubosh.
Come under my jacket. Come under my jacket. Are you okay?
Yeah.
You all
right? Yeah.
And down came the rain of rock there. Nearly a week later, a lot of unhappiness about how things are going. Here are two residents of Kathmandu talking with CBS News. Nearly a week in, the great challenges are disease and even, says one man, politics.
This is not a safe place just now. Many diseases are going to be spread here.
It's really miserable, you know. There's rain coming down, it's polluted, people are getting sick day by day. We are living hell.
Rain coming down, politics, voices there from Kathmandu. We turn to Kathmandu now, the capital of Nepal, and Donatella Lorch, former correspondent for The New York Times and for NBC News, now a contributor to NPR, The Daily Beast, The Times. She's lived in Kathmandu with her husband and child for the last 2 years. You can link to some of her terrific reporting at our website, onpointradio.org. Donatella, very good of you to take the time. Welcome back to On Point. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure, Tom.
So step back for a second and help our listeners understand sort of the state of Nepal now, nearly a week in. What's the ratio of chaos, relief, aspects that have been addressed versus unaddressed angles of the recovery?
I think mostly they're unaddressed aspects. There's growing tension. There's a lot of anxiety because we have constant aftershocks. There are a lot of rumors. They arrested two people today for spreading a false rumor yesterday afternoon on all social media saying that there would be a massive earthquake at 6 p.m. local time. And everyone was going crazy here, you know, screaming and running to each other's houses. And ultimately, the aid and help, a lot of the Western aid that's coming in is stalled at the airport. That's a government problem because the Director General of Customs is demanding people to pay, is keeping it overnight, not putting it through. And the other thing is that the big aid organizations don't really know where to go. They're supposed to be under the guidance of government, and the government is not getting much guidance. So there are places in Kathmandu that are totally up to themselves. I mean, they have to figure out how to provide themselves with tarps, how to get themselves water, and how to dig their homes out and whatever injured are still under there. I think by now it's past the magic hour, unless there's a miracle here and a miracle there. But I live next to the town of Bungamati, which is, I'd say, 13 kilometers from the airport, mm-hmm. 13 kilometers from where all the aid agencies have come into. 80% of the town is totally destroyed. I mean, I walked through it yesterday. There are piles of brick everywhere, people trying to dig for their food, dig for their clothes, anything they can rescue so that they can feed themselves. There wasn't a single member of the government. There was a little corner where there was the Nepali Red Cross. There wasn't a single foreign team, nothing. And once again, the Nepalis are showing that if someone's going to take care of them, it's their neighbors and it's their friends and it's each other.
We've heard so much about people sleeping outdoors. Here was Alina Shrestha talking with Associated Press. This is a staffer for World Vision in Nepal, describing 30 people living in her yard.
We're seeing a lot of people in temporary shelters, you know, living in tents and, yes, coming together out of their houses for fear of aftershocks.
Donatella, 2.8 million people were reading here not living in their homes. Is that evident everywhere when you go around Kathmandu?
Everywhere. I live in my garden, right outside my front door. That's where I am sitting right now doing this interview. It is everywhere that you go in the city, even on the medians in the largest roads in the city. There are people that are lying with a blanket or an umbrella against the rain or against the sun. The big problem is that the monsoon seems to be hitting early, and so it's miserable weather every other day or every other night. It was a beautiful night maybe 45 minutes ago right now, and there's already lightning coming and heavy cloud cover moving in, which, you know, for people out in the fields in particular, in these open shelters, they're 30, 40 under these tarps. And they're not tents, they're tarps. So the water just comes in sheets underneath to spend a soaking night. Tempers are running short, but even more so, the big issue is that no one's getting to where the hardest hit are supposed to be, at the epicenter and to the east, in Sindhupalchok to the east and in Gorkha to the northwest. And one thing that is not really being talked about very much, but this is an economically targeted tragedy because the earthquake destroyed mostly the houses of the poor. These are the houses built of mud and brick and stone and brick, the old, old houses that just crumpled in on each other. You know, the richer people can afford to have steel reinforced concrete. And those buildings are mostly still standing. Some of them probably are uninhabitable. Certainly the high rises are definitely uninhabitable. But they didn't crumble. Though with more aftershocks than light. So it is the question of how do you get to the northwest and how do you get to the east? And there have been riots in the east today where people have gone to the central capital there of the region, and they have just blocked the cars of people bringing relief aid and taking it away and saying it's ours. You can't keep it in the capital.
Wow. And such topography. Here's a little bit from UN's Nepal coordinator, Jamie McGoldrick, talking about the challenges of the relief effort in Nepal, especially outside the capital.
It will be a real challenge because of the topography and terrain of this country. It will be a real challenge because of the effect of the impact of the earthquake on some of these roads, and this will be problematic.
Donatella Lorch in Kathmandu, please stand by there in your garden for a moment. Jeff Shannon joins us as well from Kathmandu in Nepal now, Nepal Director for Programs for Mercy Corps. Jeff Shannon, thank you very much for being with us. What's the extent of your outfit's relief effort at this point, Jeff?
We're doing emergency relief here inside the city, but we also have teams going out to the northwest, the north, and the northeast of Kathmandu. And I think the stories that you're hearing from the others, it's the same thing that we're seeing and trying to address. The needs are so enormous. We're hearing that aid isn't moving. The thing is, aid is moving, but when you have 8 million people, we've seen distributions in some small villages that are going on. Immediately next door to it, you have a village where one woman said, not even the dogs come to visit us. And so I certainly sympathize with the government who's trying to get things done and the international community. But the needs that we're facing right here, they're overwhelming and they're heartbreaking. As much as we can put together, packages for $2 million and put them out. It's a tiny drop in the bucket. the things we're seeing again. It's heartbreaking.
What about the coordination of aid efforts? Do you see good central coordination? Is the Nepal government on top of it? Have aid groups got coordination going on? You don't want to duplicate when it's so difficult to get to any one particular place.
It's coming and it's mixed, certainly. We'll focus on the district level, so out in the rural communities. In some places we've been, even the government officials and the Nepal Red Cross Society, they're digging their own families out of the rubble. In other places you've seen, they've already gone out, they've contacted communities. And I think somebody before me said, people are forced to help each other. We see that as well, which is really heartening. In the absence of us being able to reach them or government being able to reach them, we see communities pulling together, and particularly the business community. We've been approached numerous times almost every day with businesses, factories, trying to get food, water, shelter kits out to places in Kathmandu and beyond, which is encouraging.
Jeff, you know, these disasters are never easy to work with, and yet there must be degrees of difficulty. How would you rate the difficulty of the relief challenge facing Nepal?
A woman we spoke to just 2 days ago, I think, put it really well. She said, we called it the crisis of the unknown. We were asking her about her situation, about her family. She said, I don't know. What are you doing for the next 3 days? And she said, I don't know. Again and again. And that struck me as sort of the psychological impact of this that we certainly can't ignore. They've lost so much, their homes, their relatives, their family members, their belongings, their savings, the things that they earn livelihoods from. But perhaps equally important is they just don't know what's coming tomorrow. And I think the more that we can bring in some sense of certainty, something that they can cling on to, that tomorrow something is going to happen, they can start planning again. I think that's crucial to remember as we try to put tarps and water and purification tablets and all these out into the field. People are really scared because they just don't know what's coming. And we do know in the next few months the monsoon is coming. We have this unseasonable and cold rain that's falling down now in the midst of this devastation. But the sad fact is it's going to get worse, and we need to be prepared for that as we mobilize and we fundraise around these emergency relief.
We've got to cut it right there. In Kathmandu, thank you so much for being with us. Nepal's Director of Programs for Mercy Corps. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Sound there are people yelling in the streets of Kathmandu as an aftershock hit the Nepali capital. We are looking today at the digging out, the struggle through the quake calamity in Nepal and the way ahead in Kathmandu and well beyond. Donatella Lorch is with us, former correspondent for the New York Times, NBC News, contributor now to NPR, Daily Beast, The Times. She's lived in Kathmandu for 2 years. She joins us from her garden. She, like millions of others in Nepal, afraid to go back into their homes. What was it like when it first hit? Well, here's the sound of an aid worker with the Christian group World Vision, Alina Shrestha, speaking with the Associated Press this week, remembering what it was like when the big quake hit.
It was a holiday, so I was with my boys, my 5-year-old and my 11-year-old, and we had to go to a corner in our living room before the earth actually stopped shaking, and it felt like we were in a boat, you know, moving left and right. And after the earthquake stopped, we went to the safety of our garden.
And the suffering goes on. Here's CNN's Arwa Damon yesterday reporting on conditions in a series of villages a six-hour march from the epicenter of the earthquake.
It's really hard to fully describe the magnitude of what it is that we've seen, because every single village that you go to is almost entirely destroyed. We hiked 4.5 hours up this mountain to be able to get here, and we just crossed village after village after village where there was similar devastation. We met a father whose wife was killed when a landslide swept her away.
And are tensions mounting? Yes, they are. CBS News' Seth DeWayne yesterday reporting from Kathmandu. The government, many people there are saying, just isn't doing enough.
Frustration is mounting. Clean water, power, and fuel are scarce. And we found police ready in riot gear.
This protest has popped up on the street corner here. People are yelling that the government needs to provide more aid and that there are not enough bus tickets to leave town.
Donatella Lorch joins us from Kathmandu. And questions for you, Donatella. Pankaj is calling from Boston. Pankaj, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. So my question is, we've been hearing rumors about how the Prime Minister's office has, the government has directed all the banks to channel all the funds that are being collected by individuals and private organizations into the Prime Minister's relief fund. Is there any fact to that rumor? Because it's all over the internet and social media right now.
Pankaj, thank you for your call. Donatella, what about it? Relief funds and where they're being directed?
Well, it was the talk of the town today, as a matter of fact, very true, because this would mean that the government wanted to control all money coming through here, and most likely many people would not want to give, wondering whether where the money would go once it hit the government coffers. There is talk, however, also the last that I heard before the government went home for the day, that they were going to pull back on this a bit. There's extreme dissatisfaction, and the big problem here is if the government shows a failure to address the impacts, particularly in the rural areas, by not getting aid there in time, by not showing alacrity and willingness to be flexible, that's going to create a very, very treacherous political climate. And this is where the Maoists drew their strength. It's from the rural areas and the rural areas around Gurkha and the rural areas in Sindhupalchok. And it's very important that the government reaches out right now to the people, to the remote villages, not by making these grand statements of all money goes to the Prime Minister Fund. So it's going to be, I'm sure there's going to be a different talk about it by Monday. I mean, tomorrow's weekend. Hopefully the government's working also on the weekend, considering it's a crisis here. I know that everyone else is, certainly the people who are trying to dig out their houses.
Donatella, what about the effectiveness of this government overall? It was just back in 2008 that you saw the Nepali monarchy was ended in a kind of a mass resistance then, and there's been a lot of confusion about what the long-term structure of Nepal's government would be. Do you have an effective governing system?
No, they don't have a very effective one. I mean, many Nepali friends of mine say that Nepalis here survive, struggle, and create their lives, not because of their government, but despite their government. And there has been nonstop stalemates these days before the earthquake over the constitution, because they were supposed to promulgate a constitution in January, and it got stalemated in arguments between the Maoists and the Marxist-Leninists and the Nepali Congress. Yes, there's six Maoist parties here. It's a little bit of an anachronism in this day and age, but they're here. Interestingly enough, the cartoons in the first 2 days, the political cartoons in the first 2 days after the earthquake showed, were wondering where all the leaders had gone. They hadn't appeared. They hadn't made statements. The prime minister was in Indonesia and then in Thailand, and it took a long time coming back. There was sort of no one at the helm. And right now they made a statement that the secretaries and the undersecretaries are going to go out into the countryside and talk to the people. But it's a tough road for the government, starting with how to direct the people. They're sort of lost in trying to figure out how to direct all this international aid. And I dropped by the DART team, the USAID DART team today, and it was like entering a military fortress. No one had access. They weren't out on a mission. I saw the Japanese the other day, their search and rescue teams. They weren't doing anything. In the town of Bungamati, there wasn't a soul. So who's doing what and where? It's a question of, it's very complicated, as Jamie said, to get into the countryside. Extremely complicated. In just north of Gurkha, where Jamie was up in a helicopter there yesterday, and just north of Gurkha, there's hundreds of people that have been stranded between two landslides. So they're even separated from their village. They were trying to get to help. That's from helicopters. You can see them stranded between the two landslides, but you can't get help to them.
Wow.
So Nepal is one of the most difficult places to move around. I mean, even when you have a road, it's mostly dirt. It's mostly on a precipice on one side and a sheer cliff on the other side. On a good year without earthquakes, the landslides happen because of snow, because of rain. Snow cuts most of the north out in the winter. I mean, this is a tough place where poverty, where people walk 8 hours to get to a cell phone connection in some of the zones.
Yeah, just as tough as terrain can be. I've walked into Nepal from Tibet and seen the landslides and all the rest. Shake that hard and try and bring in relief. Not easy. Never mind with all the coordination difficulties you're describing. Here's Jeff Pinnock with the World Food Program. Midweeks, he was in Gorkha saying the list of needs is long.
More helicopters, more personnel, and certainly more relief supplies, including medical teams, shelter, tents, water and sanitation and food are obviously needed.
Links to organizations that will take your donation for Nepal at our website, onpointradio.org. Will in Northborough, Massachusetts. Will, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to say, first of all, that it's a really terrible tragedy that's going on there, and I hope for a peaceful resolution. I wanted to comment that the adventuring and mountain climbing community, I've known a few people who have been to Nepal and to the Himalayas, and they just take so much enjoyment out of being there and sort of becoming a part of the community. And I wanted to maybe call them out and say that it's time to give back. They've got a very special set of skills. They know the terrain, and they can build a rapport with the people to maybe do a lot of good there.
Mountain climbers, get back in there and do some relief work right now. It's a good call, Will. Donatello Larch, many people have taken great pleasure in the amazing landscape of Nepal. It's very compelling culture, this mix of Hindu and Buddhist. Do you feel the world responding adequately now when its needs are so great, Donatella?
You know, it's interesting. Again, it's the individuals that are responding. I just heard today of a businessman here in Kathmandu that heard that in Dading, which is another very hard-hit district directly north of Kathmandu over the Shivapuri Range, and that he just he went out with his friends, raised money in this community, put a huge truck together of tarps and dal and rice, and drove it himself to Dading and distributed it himself because there were no government officials going to that area and no government aid. Another issue is helicopters. The Nepal Army doesn't have a lot of helicopters. Now, the Indians are helping out, but the Chinese have gotten involved in this and said, no Indian helicopters near our border. It's the Nepali helicopters are being torn between, are they going to be, they can't do everything. So do they do the rescues at Everest, or do they try to rescue the villagers to the north and to the north, the northeast and the northwest? Because there's still people there that want to get out of Everest. And again, the famous dilemma, because, you know, the Western world doesn't think of Nepal unless it's Everest most of the time. And, you know, last year there was a disaster in Everest, the avalanche that killed the Sherpas. And the year before there was the fight on the ice fall. And Nepal has gone through some very rough years here. So they need helicopter help. They need to be they need to get the search and rescue teams out there. But again, I'm not so sure that the Western search and rescue teams are going to be so helpful. They don't know the terrain. They don't know the people. They don't speak Nepali. They don't know how. There's some amazing search and rescue teams in Nepal. There's the Star Dogs Nepal that they were based right next to the epicenter, as a matter of fact. And they're out there bringing tarps and food to whatever villages they can reach right now.
We're going to talk with the former U.S. ambassador to Nepal about the geopolitics that may unfold here. But I want to turn first, if I may, Donatella Lorch, please stand by in Kathmandu. I want to go to Albuquerque, New Mexico, and Alok Bohara, professor of economics, director of the Nepal Study Center at the University of New Mexico. He is Nepali, lived in the U.S. for a long time. Alok Bohara, thank you very much for joining us today.
Namaste from Albuquerque, Tom.
Namaste to you. What are you hearing from friends, relatives in Nepal about current circumstances, Alok?
I've been listening to Donna Tella, and a lot of things what she said is correct. Although I would like to qualify a little bit because you know that Nepal was going through a lot of political crisis. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Prime Minister had acknowledged or has acknowledged that inefficiency in its effort. But I think they're doing their best in terms of mobilizing the army and the armed police force. So they're stressed pretty much. There are hundreds of Nepalese and other friends of Nepal and non-Nepalese all over the world raising funds and sending material supplies. And a lot of volunteers have gone to Nepal. I personally know of several of them, like in dozens and dozens in batches, are in Kathmandu collaborating with the local sort of their partner NGOs and trying to do their best. But at the national level, I agree that there is a lack of coordination, especially Nepal doesn't have what I call a FEMA-like sort of a rapid response type deal. Early on, you know, I had written an article just the other day, and this is had been my message to the authority there for the last 3-4 days, is to appoint a command center or some sort of czar, you know, maybe pick a few army generals because they are the ones who have resources. They have a network all over the country in various districts. And then maybe coordinate with them. And I think they have the resources, they have the manpower, they have, you know, all the network to team up with them and perhaps coordinate some of these international agencies. And it was very sad that even when New Zealand tried to offer some rescue, Nepal couldn't accept because they didn't have the capacity to handle and take him to, you know, to the places, you know, with helicopter. They don't have helicopters. And one point that Donna talked about, you know, which is it was a rumor, which is China saying no to Indian helicopter along their border. However, I also heard that when China offered about like 8 or 10 helicopters, you know, something happened. It didn't arrive. Either being said no, so I don't know. So maybe the compromise could have been to say, okay, so you bring your helicopters and maybe that can be used along the Chinese border. So because we cannot be, you know, get hung up on the geopolitical sort of a debate between China and India. I think
should not, but we all know that those debates can come even when they're not welcome. We're looking at Nepal digging out, struggling through. If I may, let me get a call from Spokane, Washington. Denise, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to make the comment that there are a lot of small organizations that are working directly on the ground in Nepal. I'm in Spokane right now, but I'm in contact with a lot of people. And, for example, one of the issues that we're having is that I heard from a person today whose father has an orphanage in Sindelpolchok, and they, you know, they have 92% of their homes are destroyed. They have not received any medical any help except for the government came in to give food for 20 people. And he said the only thing that that caused was a lot of fighting. They've used their emergency funds there with their little small NGO to buy food and supplies for the immediate village. But they have donors waiting outside in Australia and the United States to send money in, but they're afraid that this money is not going to be funneled to them directly, that it's going to go into this Prime Minister's fund. So I think the thing we need to do is actually talk with the Nepalese embassy here in the United States to have them put pressure on their government to allow these funds to flow in to these small organizations because they're on the ground. They're actually doing things, and they're not distributing small, small packets of things which are causing the conflict. We've worked in Nepal for 30 years. We have a fair trade business there, and we, you know, have a clinic up in the Thing District trying to get supplies up into that area. And we had to wire money to India to get to buy tents to bring them across the border, and are just hoping that the government's not going to get in the way of those tents coming in and being distributed up in the Basiri region where they have had no shelter now for a week.
You don't want concern about that slowing down help from abroad, certainly, Denise. A point well made. Donatella, what about those concerns and the flow of aid coming in through the main airport in Kathmandu?
Well, I totally agree with what the lady just said right now. I mean, a lot of them are the small NGOs. I think the big problem with all the volunteers that are coming here, let me address that first, is that all these people want to come and help, and I think that's a very commendable thing to do. But in this chaos, is they just create in many ways an extra thing for people to worry about, because they need to have direction, they need to be told do this, do that, as opposed to the critical things, which are the small NGOs that have been there for a long time, that know their people, know their terrain, know how to where the food is.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
का कोटी कोटी संपदा को दातने जय हरुले.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Sound there from a vigil in Queens in New York. Nepali immigrants here singing the national anthem. The whole world staring at these images coming out of mountainous Nepal and the destruction from the 7.8 earthquake that hit last weekend and the many aftershocks, many of them quite substantial. Almost 3 million people living outside their homes in Nepal, many under just a scrap of tarp at this point. Rains have come in. It's tough, and relief has not been easy to deliver. Donatella Lorch joins us from Kathmandu, former correspondent for the New York Times, NBC News. She's been there for a couple of years now. You can link to her reporting at our website, onpointradio.org, where you can also find a list of organizations getting help to Nepal. Alok Bohara is with us, professor of economics, director of the Nepal Study Center at the University of New Mexico. Nepali, been in the U.S. a long time now. A couple of calls right here, if I may. Then we'll go to the former U.S. ambassador to Nepal, James Moriarty, joining us from Hawaii in just a second. But first, Marcia, Providence, Rhode Island. Marcia, you're on the air.
Hi. I know Nepal very, very well, having worked there for many years. I've been all over the country, and I know the situation in Kathmandu intimately. I'd like to speak in favor of what a previous one of your previous guests said, that Nepal needs a czar. They need some person in charge, because the government is totally dysfunctional. It is famously corrupt. Indeed, all the money goes into government pockets, but the government itself is disorganized and dysfunctional and just doesn't operate as a government. It's taken them over 10 years to write a constitution, and they're still not there. They've been squabbling and bickering. They cannot get themselves together. And in this moment of extreme crisis, with people in villages that are off roads that cannot be reached by road, only a central organized, coordinated command structure can begin to organize this and bring help to the helpless and extremely poor people.
Marcia, we've got Alok Bahar. There's a pretty tough critique of Nepal and its government, dysfunctional, corrupt, and in a crisis like this, you've got to cut through that. What do you say?
let's see. I just want to qualify a little bit what I said earlier, in the sense that what I meant by czar was not to have a czar of the country. I meant
emperor,
czar about the relief program. And the second thing is, we also had a small, and we were also concerned about this news coming out of Kathmandu about Prime Minister funds being used as a centralized place to deposit money. So we had done a little bit of a candlelight vigil here at the University of New Mexico last night, and we're going to donate our money to this organization in North America, and they have a very good groundwork or the sort of their organization, NGO in Nepal. And the fund, they just informed me that the fund transfer is on hold until we get a clarification. And I contacted someone, you know, closer to the administration, and I heard that it was, I hope it was a rumor, it was a sort of a misinterpretation. What they were trying to say was the Prime Minister's fund or the Prime Minister's office wanted to keep track of who is coming to Nepal, not to grab the money. But then it's not very clear. So we just want clear statement from the Prime Minister's office, actually, that it is it is for the tracking, you know, like people reporting the Prime Minister's office that this is what we're bringing, this is how much money. But the discretion of carrying out the effort and the distribution of the relief funds and all that should lie with the organization themselves rather than the Prime Minister's fund. Yeah. So I think that that needs to be clarified. It's a mixed information as far as I can tell. So we have to hold our judgment until we hear from the Prime Minister's mouth directly.
Donatello,
so I've requested that.
Yeah, Donatello, you hear our listeners' deep skepticism about this government. You've said that there's great concern in Nepal itself of a coup or uprising, maybe not immediately here, but in the tumult that has been triggered by the quake.
Tom, were you addressing me? I couldn't hear.
Yes, Donatella.
Sorry. Well, in response to the creation of a czar, it's lovely an idea, and it's really wishful thinking here. It's not going to happen, and certainly not going to happen in the midst of a disaster, and it's not in the spur of a moment in this. The government is permanently squabbling. There's a lot of corruption, there's a lot of disorganization, the right hand doesn't know what the left hand wants, and you can even see this when you arrive at the airport. You were asking me earlier about the airport, and the airport's a perfect microcosm of what's going on in Nepal, grown to beyond the size that it can handle, like the tourism and this, that, and the other, and the government, at some levels, the government is trying its best to function. The problem is that they have their mind elsewhere, and they weren't prepared to deal with this incredible extreme disaster. No one was, even though they had been preparing for it with a larger UN and international partners consortium for years, because everyone was told, it's coming, it's coming. The U.S. Embassy used to have it on its front page of its website. Beware, this is an earthquake-prone zone, and there's a big earthquake predicted, and on and on. And, what can the government do right now? I think the best way forward is to see whether international pressure can get it to not do this fund. And there was talk already. There was a lot. This is everybody in Kathmandu was talking about this. It was all over the airwaves and with incredible discontent from the Nepalese. And the government has in the past backed down when the people really get angry, such as in tuition hikes, such in new rules and regulation, new taxes. If people get very angry, the government has backed down. So in the next coming days, we'll see what happens. Now, the only thing right now is to go forward and find a way forward to help the people who are stranded, because it's not only helping them initially. Is an earthquake is a long process to get over. It doesn't finish the minute you give someone some tarps. You have to do more than give tarps. You have to help rebuild, and that becomes incredibly complicated. And in many ways, it's simpler in the countryside to rebuild. In the city, it's much more complicated. They'll have to bring down many, many buildings that are uninhabitable right now. So what can the government do right now? It's stay together. There is a lot of talk here, a lot of talk about pressure from India. I had Nepali friends today talking about this is a soft invasion of India. There was an Indian military truck in downtown Patan this today, which was, I found, very interesting. people are wondering. They're glued to the analysis on the Indian television stations. Nepalis are. They want to know what the two big neighbors are thinking.
I want to look at that right now, if I may, Donatella. If you'll excuse me there in Kathmandu, I have joining us right now from Kailua, Hawaii, Ambassador James Moriarty. He was Special Assistant for Asia to the U.S. President, 2002-2004. He was U.S. Ambassador to Bangladesh, 2008-2011. But before that, he was American Ambassador to Nepal from 2004 to 2007. He's now Senior Advisor, South Asia, for the consulting firm Bauer Group Asia, non-resident fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Ambassador Moriarty, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on today.
Nepal is going to require an awful lot of help. It has these two giant neighbors between which it is sandwiched, China to the north, India to the south. Who's liable to play the larger role in rebuilding? Will either of them or one of them move in a very, very large way to help Nepal take on the challenges it now faces?
Well, I think both countries believe that they have a lot at stake in Nepal. China worries much about the border with Tibet that Nepal has, is worried that there could be assistance for the Tibetans coming out of Nepal at some point. The Indians, meanwhile, want to have a very friendly Nepal sitting on that border with China, much of which is disputed between the two big countries. So they both feel they have a lot at stake. But India has really deep historical ties with the country. There are probably 3 million Nepalis living in India. And frankly, a lot of Indians, or at least people who have rights to Indian passports, living in Nepal too. So there's very, very close personal contacts, very close economic contacts. And meanwhile, the two big powers are jockeying to make sure that Nepal remains friendly to them.
Is there open tension over Nepal? We heard this report that China had said, we don't want Indian helicopters too near our border. Some skepticism about that report. But is this does it have a sense of a contested country between these large powers?
No, I would not go that far, mm-hmm. because I think the Chinese realize the facts of geography. Basically, they have a very mountainous border with Nepal. The Indian border is lowland, and because of that, as I said earlier, you've had a huge mixture of people. The border between India and Nepal is open. Any Nepali can walk across into India, and any Indian can walk across into Nepal. The religion is the same. Languages are largely the same. You probably have a third of the people in Kathmandu can speak Hindi. So you have a lot of mixture. China recognizes that, but yet China doesn't want Nepal to be seen as being just a satellite of India.
What about the United States in this mix, Ambassador Moriarty? The first announcement we heard was of a few rescue folks being sent and $1 million, which seemed very small given the magnitude of the challenge here. What's the American presence and interest in Nepal?
Well, first of all, I want to add quickly that we've now added 9 million to that. So we're up to 10 million for the immediate mm-hmm. relief of Nepal. Having been in Bangladesh after a big cyclone hit there, my guess is that additional funds are going to be coming in from the United States once Congress gets around to looking at the question. What is our interest? We want to see a prosperous and stable Nepal. We want democracy to succeed in Nepal. We don't want this to become a fount for instability in South Asia.
Alok Bahara, how do you see China and India here, and who is more likely to offer more in terms of support for Nepal?
I think both of them were the first responders landing in Nepal with the help. And Nepal has a very cordial relationship with both countries. And I think for Nepal, it's not the time to play one over the other. I think they have to reach out to both. And both countries are right now in number two and three economy, in a world economy. Very big. And I think Nepal can take advantage of both countries. That's my view. And I even wrote one a thesis in 2010 proposing a trilateral economic cooperative agreement between Nepal, China, and India. I think that's the new way forward, given the new emerging economic sort of a vitality in that region. So we can't be playing this old Cold War type scenario. As far as Nepal is concerned, Nepal has to look after its own interests. And Nepal's interest is to be a good and have a strong cooperation with both countries. And I hope Nepal also reaches out to both countries in terms of helicopters and other facilities. That might even start a new sort of a sense of cooperation between these three countries. That's how I feel about it.
Donatella Lorch in Kathmandu. The world knows Nepal for Mount Everest, but also for this unique, charming, beguiling culture and architecture. Those temples, everybody knows the sort of pagoda roofed or big eaved temples, which are amazing, but amazingly vulnerable as well. Those are a big magnet for tourists, which are an important industry for Nepal. How bad a hit has that kind of built culture taken in this earthquake week, Donatella?
It's taken a huge hit. Nepal's visible history, its monuments, its biggest temples in Kathmandu and elsewhere are gone, completely gone. I mean, you still have Pashupatinath Temple, the holiest Shiva shrine, one of the holiest Shiva shrines in the world and a World Heritage Site that was relatively unscathed.
and the stupa at Bodnat is relatively unscathed, but everything else is gone. What's lovely and wonderful about Kathmandu and Nepal is the living religion,
yes,
and the living culture that is everywhere. It's the stone that you worship while you're on a motorcycle driving, yes, by the street. It's the pipal tree that the road has to go around, and the little fence around the shrine because it just happens to be in the middle of the road, but you're not going to destroy it. The road has to go around.
And all
it.
The fragile wooden carving and so much wonderful.
It is, walking through Bungamati yesterday, the home of the Red God at the Ratu Machendranath. It was a 12-year festival, as a matter of fact, that was coming through my neighborhood the day before the earthquake, was, pulling the Red God with hundreds, yeah, of people in a chariot. And it's all gone. It's all gone. So what is the culture, the heritage that is left for the new generation? And, it's heartbreaking for me. I always feel like I have a stone in my stomach everywhere I go when I go through these old villages. And it's the same, from what I understand, people who've been in helicopters and seen the temples and the hills and this like that. They're down to the ground. So it's going to take a huge amount. They were rebuilt, the Darbar Squares went down in the 1934 earthquake, and they were rebuilt.
In Kathmandu, yeah.
So, in Kathmandu, yeah, and in Darbar Square in Patan. Mm-hmm. But that takes time, and it takes money, and it takes energy. And is this going to happen right now? There are many more people that live in Nepal than there were in 1934 during the last earthquake. Or as a friend of mine's father said, who witnessed the 1934 earthquake and witnessed Saturday's earthquake, he says it's the same dance, but just different people.
Alok Bahara, we just have half a minute. Is there the craftsmanship to bring back the old culture as the people struggle themselves to survive in Nepal?
Absolutely, absolutely. They've done in 1934 with so much little resources. They can do it again. And the first priority would be to safeguard all those wooden carving and the bricks and everything that has fallen. So that needs to be preserved and stop, people from taking it to home and all that. I think that should be the first priority as far as that's concerned.
Watch out for that. We can just imagine the trucks carrying that south into an international market. So beautiful,
yeah,
so precious, and so imperiled right now in Nepal. Alok Bahara at the Nepal Study Center at the University of New Mexico, thank you very much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
Ambassador James Moriarty joining us from the Bauer Group Asia today from Kailua, Hawaii. Ambassador Moriarty, thank you so much for your time and insights.
Thanks for having me.
And Donatella Lorch in Kathmandu with us today in her garden house. We hope is safe. Donatella, you be safe. Thank you for joining us.
It was such a pleasure, Tom. Namaste.
Namaste. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.